Did Master say it? Did Yogananda say it? Because if Yogananda said it was true, then he didn't dare refute it. Even if he couldn't accept it or understand it, he couldn't refute it. But if it came from some other source, he allowed himself to treat it more skeptically. Because you see, a master, and you have to become convinced that you're dealing with one, is talking about consciousness from the top of the mountain. Yogananda, he was what's known as a self-realized master, a fully realized being who had escaped from all the limiting conditions that bind the rest of us. And what binds us is very simple. What binds us is our own sense of who we are. You know, when you ask, who am I? And we answer, how do we answer? I mean, we can answer theoretically, I am one with the infinite spirit, I am a child of God. But when somebody wakes you up in the middle of the night, when someone comes at you with a gun, when you're going down the freeway and you think you're going to have a crash, when you lose your job and you don't know where you're going to get another one, then a whole lot of other sense of who I am and what I am comes to the fore, doesn't it? There was a very interesting story of, it's called The Hiding Place, and it's a story about this very noble Dutch family that helped, this was during the Nazi occupation of the Netherlands, and how that family helped hide Jews. And there was this older woman named Corrie ten Boom. And the Gestapo would always raid in the middle of the night when everybody was very confused and sleeping. And so they had to train themselves to come out of a dead sleep and be able to, you know, deal with crisis in the right way, because they had a hiding place where all the Jews in their house would rush to at the first sign of trouble. And the people who lived there legitimately had to stall them. So they would, her nephew would constantly break in and wake her up from a deep sleep and say, where are the Jews? Where are the Jews? And she had to learn to say from complete sleep, there are no Jews in this house. What are you talking about? And she would invariably say, behind the wall in the hiding place. Because, I mean, it just took her time just to be able to remember. Now, I've always thought of that is when somebody wakes me from a deep sleep and says, who are you? Who are you? What is your true reality? You know, what are you going to answer? Because what you answer in that moment is what you really believe. And I can say that I have this elevated understanding, but when we're pressured, that's when it comes. I had a very interesting story today, just by the way. This woman is an acquaintance of mine. She lives in Seattle. And she's a student of yoga and a student of meditation, and she has a deep faith in God and a belief that the guru takes care of you, all the things that should make you courageous. She was at her bank, and there was a bank robbery at her bank. And, you know, people came in with guns, and it was very scary. Nobody was hurt. But she was terrified, just, you know, inwardly, just totally panicked. And afterwards, she was a bit ashamed of herself because she thought, you know, where is my faith in God? Where is my truth that suddenly when something comes at me that I don't want, I fall to pieces. So she redoubled her spiritual efforts and really began to practice an every moment attunement with a greater reality than just her ego and her personality. And believe it or not, 3 years almost to the day, she went into that same bank and there was another robbery. I mean, it's like, to whom does this happen? But she was so proud of herself because it was even worse than the one before. But she never became frightened. She had changed her sense of who I am sufficiently that, well, they're threatening my body, but they can't threaten my peace of mind. You know, they're dark energies, but I don't have to let that dark energy define me. And not only did she not become afraid, but she was able to calm down several other people and actually even managed to escape a little bit from the worst part of it and, you know, take some other people to a safer place. But, you know, surviving it was nice, but what she was most proud of was that she had changed her deep sense of herself sufficiently. Now, a master has incarnated a sufficient number of times. A master is really just a graduate of this school. We're undergraduates. He's a graduate. He has lived through sufficient numbers of incarnations, just like the ones we're living, but he has applied himself, or if it happens to be in a female body, usually it's male. In fact, virtually always it's male, because the nature of an avatar, it's a masculine kind of work. because it's a world-changing, moving kind of work. When very advanced souls are born in female bodies, they tend to, like, there's a story of Ananda Moy Ma in here. She never did anything. She just sat there and radiated absolute bliss and uplifted, you know, tens of thousands of people for 70 years. But she never really did anything because she was a feminine expression. And the feminine expression was to be. The masculine expression is to do. I mean, that's a long conversation, but because there's a choice, they don't have to be either male or female. What would you like to say?
Is it okay to ask a question?
Yeah.
Okay, other people claim to be masters, and they turned out to be seminar leaders leading cults. So
right.
Wouldn't Swami want people to question sometimes? I'm a little confused by that.
Well, of course you have to question. But you also have to have confidence that there are answers.
Sure.
The difficulty is that people tend to believe because not everyone who asserts something is true, that therefore everybody who asserts something is false. And that's what we're dealing with right now in our culture, is because so much is false, people have lost faith that anything is true. I mean, I wrote this book, which is nothing but firsthand accounts, and I didn't write it with adjectives, I wrote it with facts, because I figured adjectives were useless. What's the point of adjectives? If I just use a lot of adjectives, I'm just... You know, and I took a lot of other people's stories, and I had to work very hard with them because everybody loves adjectives. It's wonderful, it's exciting, it's uplifting, it's blissful. Just what happened, you know? And then let people decide from what happened what they're going to decide. You know, there's nobody that can convince you of a spiritual truth. I want to take this thought right to where I have been going this whole time. There's nobody who can convince you. One has to become sensitive enough in oneself and confident enough in one's own experience of the right kind. And the one true thing, which is what we're talking about, is that which expands, is that energy flows within us. When energy flows in an upward direction within us, it leads us into bliss and out of suffering. When energy flows in a downward direction within us, it leads us to greater contraction and greater suffering. The one true thing is that energy needs to be interiorized and it needs to be raised. Now, you start with the simple fact that if we watch ourselves, every time our suffering increases, we have a corresponding sense of sinking. And every time our happiness increases and our joy increases, we have a corresponding sense of upliftment. Now, energy, literally in the yoga science, is always circulating up and down. We started with the breath, the inhalation and the exhalation of the breath. The inhalation and the exhalation of the breath are the manifestation of the fact that subtle energy is going up and down the spine, through the chakras. The chakras are the subtle centers. The energy circulates up and down through those chakras all the time, through the astral body. And because that energy is circulating, we breathe. And when the life force withdraws, we stop breathing. Or if you go into a very high state of manifestation of meditation where you're only living in the energy, then you don't breathe, but you don't die either. Now, starting from that simple fact, which is we begin to look at our life in terms of what causes the energy to rise and what causes the energy to sink. I'll give a really simple example. This is 100% of my knowledge of feng shui, which I'm going to tell you. I'm about to tell you my whole story about feng shui, which I know very little, but I have applied this continuously and it served me magnificently. My friend, who is a master of that particular art, of, you know, making your environment what you want it to be. I was moving. No, I was actually just clearing my house out because of a whole bunch of things that had happened and it needed to be cleared out. She said, take everything that is in your house, one thing at a time, hold it in your hand, and see what it does to your energy. You know, so I pick up some little tchotchke that is I've never liked, you know, that somebody gave me, but I've been afraid to throw it away because what if their feelings get hurt, you know? And I know the person doesn't even really like me and I don't particularly like them, but I've held on to this little ugly thing. Soon as you put it in your hand, you know, you feel like this, right? So she says, if it causes your energy to sink, just get it out of your life, because everywhere it is, every time you touch it, it's going to cause your energy to sink. Isn't that so? Or I you know, you pick up this and like, Oh, this is my, well, this happens to be a picture of Yogananda, so this is beautiful, so I'll pretend it's not. I'll turn it over and pretend it's not. Oh, there it is. You know, my uncle so-and-so, you know, he was just such a mean fellow. And, you know, but my mother, we always had to go there, and I just really never liked looking. Or he was such an unhappy man, you know, just the mere thought of him makes me, get rid of it. Just get it out of your house. Don't keep it anymore. And then you pick up something else. Well, I'll pick up this because this happens to be mine. Oh, look at that beautiful thing. I remember when we bought that, my husband and I were in Seattle together. We went to this little shaker store and, you know, it's just, and it's functional. Keeps my key, my car key really nice. And every time I look at it, it makes me happy. So, but of course I'll keep it. And then maybe there's something in between. This, useless. I mean, ugly, not particularly attractive, but gee, it holds the book up just right. So you keep it. But it's just a simple test. Does it cause your energy to rise? Does it cause your energy to sink? Because if it rises, then you're going where you're trying to go. If it sinks, you're not going anywhere you want to go. What happens when we eat too much of foods that aren't good for us? Do we feel light and energetic afterwards? No, of course not. We feel our energy is really pulled down. What happens if somebody speaks to you and you're very impatient and you're not nice to them? Then afterwards, you have a sinking feeling inside of you, isn't it? Sometimes you have a process of something that you have to do, and it's not, you know, and you feel it just, it pulls you down even to think about it. Now, sometimes we have to, and this is what I need to talk about a little more, we have to find techniques to raise our energy to face what we have to do. We can't just, every time our energy sinks, run away, because that'll make our energy really, really sink, you know, to constantly be hiding from what we have to do. But the one true thing about life is that you can tell everything from whether the energy rises or the energy falls. And insofar as you can gain mastery of your energy, which is, that's what the science of yoga is. The science of yoga is the art of making the energy interior and raising it. It's as simple as that. You can be a native, an aborigine in some African country. You can be the king of France. And still, your life is going to be whether the energy is rising or sinking. And that's all that you're ever going to be experiencing. Now, someone like Yogananda has mastered that flow of energy, and that energy is completely at his command. So he has endless willpower. He has endless willpower to transcend any limiting physical condition. He can transcend the limitations of the body. He can transcend the limitations of time and space. And he manifested it repeatedly. Now, how can you know that such a person is such a person? Well, when you begin to become sensitive to your own rising and falling energy, you can begin to gauge your own experiences by how it affects that energy. Will you make mistakes? Oh, my goodness, yes. But one experiences the consequences of those mistakes and then moves forward again. The difficulty, as I was saying now, is that there's just so much, such a candy store is the way my friend described it. There's so many options and so many false assertions that a person has to really cultivate within them the inner capability to be aware of what your, of how things affect you and what your own experiences are, and then to be able to pay attention over a long enough rhythm so that you can begin to trust it. Because if you can't trust that inner sense, well, we're really at sea, is where we are. And that's partly what's going on in our culture right now, is that nobody teaches you how to be inwardly aware and really strong within yourself. Even when they're trying to teach you nowadays, quote, self-esteem and so on, They're trying to teach it so much from the outside. Ananda runs a school for children. We have a pre-K through 8th grade school. And when we first started that school, it's been going on for about 17 years now. I was one of the founders. I'm not a children's teacher, but I'm an entrepreneur. So there's a certain point where all projects are the same. And so as long as the school was just a project, my husband and I got it off the ground. When it really became a real school, then we had to get more people who really knew how to run a school, and then we withdrew. But I was very involved for about 7 years. And We went to visit a number of the other private schools in the area, and we went to one of the most prestigious schools. I'll say its name. It's called Nueva. It's a very good school. I mean, I couldn't fault it, and I don't want to. Well, I can speak about what they teach and what they don't teach. They don't teach what we do. We went there. They teach many great things. They have a beautiful facility. I'm not wanting to run them down. But I was there, and there was a self-esteem tree in like the fourth or fifth grade. And they were obviously trying to address this issue. And it was, and every child had put a leaf on that tree. And what they put on the tree was, I feel good about myself because. And every single leaf on that tree, except for one, was, I feel good about myself because of something that they had accomplished. Now, of course, that is one way to feel good about yourself. If you accomplish things, you feel better than if you're just a lump just sitting there and doing nothing. So the fact that, you know, I read these books or I won this award or I got an A on my math test, those are all good things. It's not like it's worthless. But that was basically the basis for their self-worth. Only one spoke of self-mastery. One child said, I feel better about myself because I'm not as moody as I used to be. But all the rest of them were based on accomplishment. Now, of course, what happens when they no longer can accomplish? Because they become ill, because the competition gets too stiff, because they've given their life to playing the guitar and they get tendonitis, you know, or some unkind person takes advantage of them. What happens then to your self-esteem? What happens to their parents when they lose their jobs and their whole identity has been based on what they were able to do? It's, of course, very important to be able to accomplish, but what's important about it is it indicates a level of self-mastery. And self-mastery is the ability to keep the energy inwardly strong and upwardly directed. If we think about everything that happens to us, when we fall into states of sadness and despair, it's because we've allowed ourselves to become externally oriented, and whatever it is has caused our energy to sink. And when we recover, it's because we have managed to pull our sense of self in to the center of our being and not be so defined and identified by whatever external thing has pulled us down, and because also we're raising our energy up again. And raising energy means you have energy, you have optimism, you have hope, you have a plan. You don't necessarily feel great. You have one of the eight manifestations of spirit, which is love, joy, peace, calmness, energy, light, wisdom. You know, you have one of these going on somewhere. And it's interesting to note, you know, energy and calmness don't really say that anything's going well. Everything can still be a total mess, but you have energy and calmness. So here I am, you know, I have two children to raise. Now I'm by myself. You know, that job isn't working, and I'm going to go forward and do this. The energy begins to go up again instead of just quivering and saying, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? What am I going to do? And then wisdom begins to come, ideas begin to come, and we feel lighter about it. Okay, does that make sense? Now, apply this to any situation you're in ever in your life, and it will always work. If you're feeling bad, the energy is going down, has become externalized. When you're feeling better, you've drawn the energy back into yourself. Your sense of self has drawn back into yourself, and you found a way to bring it up. Now, the practices of yoga, the science of yoga in its totality, is about interiorizing and raising the energy. Yoga postures, as it is originally intended, is about interiorizing and raising the energy. The way people practice it now, it's so outward and aerobic, and the noise is loud and all this stuff. It's just nothing. It's just exercises. But the way it's really meant to be practiced, the postures affirm states of consciousness, and they're all inwardly and upward. We have a whole yoga program called Ananda Yoga, which also has affirmations that go with every pose. I mean, I'm just speaking of it, not wanting just to sell what we do, but so you understand. So that when you hold a certain posture, you also affirm the state of consciousness that goes with it, and the body and the mind work together. And at the end of that kind of yoga practice, you're inwardly centered and you're uplifted, which then leads to wisdom, to hope, to joy, to peace, to energy, all the things that you need. The practice of meditation, just the simple practice we were doing, we're watching the breath. That's how we started, isn't it? Okay, everyone, sit up straight, bring yourself present here, watch yourself breathe. Where does the breath take place? The breath takes place right down the center of our being. And the energy center of our being is the astral spine around which the physical body is built, which is a pole of energy that runs from the top of the head right through the center of the body to the base of the spine. It's not the bony spine back here. It's a shaft of light and energy that runs right through the middle, around which this whole thing is built. And we manifest a body, and then we identify with the body. But what we really are is that flow of energy in the center. That's why a person can be totally paralyzed and unable to speak and still be themselves. That's why the physical body can be cut off just to the torso, from the top of the head to the base of the spine, and it's still there. If you take off more than that, you no longer, the body can't survive. But it can survive all the way down to that point, because that's who we really are. And when a person dies, they die from the extremities inwardly. And dying is merely withdrawing that shaft of energy and light and returning to the non-physical world, which is where we hang out between these physical incarnations. And so when you die, nothing happens at all. You're just not physical anymore. You still are, I say almost unfortunately, yourself. You don't shed your ego just by shedding your body. But the one true thing is, the more we identify with that inward flow of energy, and less with the manifestations of that energy. Now, what that means is, for example, if you're a creative person, if your creativity is all about, is everybody going to like my painting? Are they going to like my song? Is this book really going to sell? Am I going to get money for this thing? Then your creativity itself is stymied to begin with, because your consciousness is not on the flow of energy. But the best and the greatest artists, and all of your best creative experiences, I'm sure, just like mine, is when one forgets and everything except the sheer joy of being in that flow of energy. Whether you're sewing or writing poetry or writing music or cooking, when there's just this feeling of just the flow of energy. The athletes call it being in the zone, don't they?